This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. If you've noticed how quickly younger folks have glommed on to high technology, you may not have noticed that there's also a trend to more rustic pleasures like knitting and home canning. Emily Matcher is a writer who thinks that it's not just a small trend. She calls it the new domesticity, and she connects it to larger social and political change. Emily's new book is called Homeward Bound, Why Women Are Embracing the New Domesticity. She's going to read tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, tomorrow at The Regulator, and is here with us now. Emily Matcher, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
What is the new domesticity?
Well, you know, I define the new domesticity as the resurgence of interest in old-fashioned domestic things from, knitting and crocheting and other crafts to home canning to, those people raising chickens in their backyard, all the way through to some, more intensive methods of parenting, attachment parenting, all the way through to, real homesteading where people are trying to live off the grid at the most extreme end of it. And this is, all to do with people who have the means and the education to reject these things if they wanted to.
So how widespread do you think it is? Any way to measure how big it is and how fast it's growing?
You know, there's so many different facets of it, but, to give you some statistics, just jam canning, home canning, which, was almost dead, has gone up like crazy in the past few years. Sales of canning goods have increased by like 35%. The sale of the Ball canning book, which is sort of the Bible of home canning, just doubled in the past, year or 2 years. Homeschooling, which is something I look at, has gone from like 850,000 homeschooled kids in the late 90s all the way through to 1.5 million today. And some people think it's more like 2.5 million. So we can look at these, these facets of new domesticity and see how they've grown.
And something that tells us about the change is the demographics in that. Take homeschooling for one. Homeschooling used to be the domain of particularly conservative folk who were worried about more liberal and progressive ideas in the school system. And so as particularly religious fundamentalists, to take one group that tended toward this kind of homeschooling. Now it's much more wide open, and we're finding progressives, people on the other end of the political spectrum, populating that particular area.
Exactly. And that is what is so interesting to me, is that a lot of the growth in homeschooling is not among these religious conservatives who have traditionally been the base of homeschoolers. You see a lot of extremely liberal, progressive people who, are saying, well, I think public schools, they're not good enough, or they, they squash kids' creativity, or I want my kids to learn at their own pace, or I want them to sort of be unschooled and learn from doing, who really have, quite opposite beliefs from the traditional homeschoolers.
And again, if you think about canning and knitting and some of these other things, they're in a sense conservative, not necessarily politically conservative, but the idea that you're conserving resources, that it's about being around the hearth and not taking things, commodifying and professionalizing everything. So all of this is moving toward the progressive end of the spectrum.
Right. That is so true. And this is one of the things that, I point out in the book and I find really interesting. People always did knitting. People always did home crafts, but they were traditionally associated with an older, more conservative demographic. And it's only in the past, maybe 10, 15 years, but especially in the last five, that young people, people who probably consider themselves, fairly hip, fairly with it, are embracing these things, and they're embracing it for very different reasons than their predecessors. They're embracing it, because of environmental reasons. They're embracing it because they want to live, they want to be less dependent on corporations, because they embrace a DIY lifestyle.
It's interesting to talk about that, the DIY culture in all of this, because in a lot of ways, one of the strands of DIY is technological. The idea that you can do so much online with an iPhone, with digital technology, does that somehow promote a culture of do-it-yourself that actually leads back to these more kind of hands-on, tangible crafts?
Well, one of the things that, one of the sort of, I don't know if it's an irony of the new domesticity, is that it wouldn't exist without technology, I don't think. so much of this is spread through technology. You have the whole resurgence of crafting among younger people. That is really an effective technology. You know, if we didn't have, you know, sites like Etsy or, you know, these knitting sites or Pinterest, you know, people now can spread around, you know, old-fashioned knowledge via the internet. If I want to learn how to knit, you know, I mean, my grandmother may have tried to teach me when I was younger, but she's gone now. And, you know, I can go on YouTube and there are a million, you know, people who are willing to teach me how to knit or how to can jam or all of these sort of lost domestic arts are now having a resurgence online. And blog culture also, these lifestyle blogs, have really sort of made the stuff look attractive and fun and interesting and have really driven a lot of the resurgence.
So I can learn a lot of this all by myself online, sitting at my kitchen table. A lot of these crafts and activities were done communally, knitting, canning. People were more than one person was in the kitchen at the time, sometimes more than one family represented. Is that part of this sort of neoclassical, neo-craft culture? Communalism?
I think a lot of people that are involved in the new domesticity will talk a lot about community, about wanting to create community. And these communities may look very different than communities did 50 or 100 years ago. You know, 100 years ago, if you were into quilting or you know, sewing, you might be part of a sewing circle. You might do quilting bees. And those things are, you know, really long dead, but they're kind of coming back thanks in part to technology. That, you know, you can go on you know, Ravelry is a very popular knitting site. You can go on Ravelry and you can share your knitting patterns and you can sort of create an electronic knitting circle. So you have a very high-tech version of something, a very old-fashioned form of community.
There's another trend in this that also kind of connects again back to the conservative trend or the conservative ethos, and that would be the kind of distrust of government. That's embedded in this or inherent, at least in some of the trend. Is that right?
There really is in some of this. You know, I mean, not in all of it, obviously. You know, people who are knitting are just, you know, maybe doing that for fun. But I think people that are really involved wholeheartedly in the sort of lifestyle of new domesticity, there is a major thread of distrust in government and institutions, and it goes from, you know, distrust of big food. I think that's a huge part of it. People not trusting, you know, where their food comes from, wanting to know where it comes from, wanting to not buy it from, you know, factory farms, all the way through to people, you know, not trusting public schools, feeling like there might, you know, they're going to squelch their children's creativity, you know, all the way through to people not trusting, you know, modern medicine and wanting to, you know, make their own decisions about, you know, childbirth and, you know, go, you know, do it at home with a midwife or, you know, even people that reject vaccines. I think that can get tied in with the culture. Again, not everyone involved in this culture is doing these things, but I think you definitely see a very strong thread of anti-government, anti-institution belief.
It's interesting to see that, again, in those places where it shows up, this fear or mistrust of government, again, long associated with a conservative political ethos. And yet what also has changed is who controls the government. So in the 50s and 60s, when government was devoted to public service and public enterprise, trusted government was a liberal, right, a progressive philosophy. These days, as dollars vote more than people do and corporations have much more control over the body politic, it would be interesting to see, maybe not surprising, to see progressives say, well, this is no longer our government. This is big oil's government. You can look in the state of North Carolina to see the influence of corporate money on public policy.
Yeah, well, you know, 100 years ago, you know, so going back a little bit further, you have what was called the Progressive Era. And the Progressive Era was all about government regulation. So if you were a progressive back then, that meant that you were, you know, fighting for more government regulation. That's when the Pure Food and Drug Act came in 1906 that, you know, made it so we can't have, you know, your candy can't be adulterated with arsenic and your milk can't, you know, have pus in it. You know, these were things that were just completely unregulated. And that was when, you know, public school, you know, became mandatory and when, you know, a lot of the vaccines came onto the scene and started being, you know, given to the public. And now I think, yes, absolutely, people who define themselves as progressives, I think, define themselves in a large part by skepticism. And so much of that is really warranted skepticism. You know, you talk about big oil, big food. You know, the government is, you know, in such a large sense in the pocket of corporations. You know, I also On the downside, I think there's, you know, it can be problematic if people reject government solutions as a way of making large change, because I think, you know, we can do so much at home, but we really need to have large governmental changes, you know, in terms of things like environmental regulation and food safety if we really want to have change for everybody.
When the government took cocaine out of Coca-Cola, that's when they went too far in my book. I'll never forgive them for that.
Amen.
So it's interesting to hear you say that. I mean, on the one hand, if it's a complete withdrawal from any hope in a government, a kind of unified corporate government response to this, then that could be damaging in a sense. Is there also a way in which alternative structures are being created? In other words, rather than go head to head in the political marketplace and try to outvote, you know, the other side, we'll say we're just going to build a new one over here. And while they're sorting that out, since they're awfully big, we'll just make this new one on the side.
You definitely see that in these smaller ways. You see people going, well, we don't like our school system. We're going to have some sort of, you know, co-op school in our neighborhood, or we're not happy with food. We're going to do this local farmers market, or, you know, all these buy local movements that you see where people are, you know, encouraging others to, you know, to not shop at big box stores and instead shop at, you know, at local craft markets or at local stores. And that stuff is so great. I think it, you know, can definitely have an effect. It's definitely wonderful. It's definitely steps in the right direction. Do I think that it can replace the government that we have, or that there's going to be some sort of major overthrow? No, I don't think so. So I think, you know, we really need to be working both within and without the system.
The book is Homeward Bound, Why Women Are Embracing the New Domesticity. Emily Matcher is the author. And so let's talk about the second part of this, why women are embracing the new domesticity. Is this putting more pressure on women, do you think?
Well, you know, women have historically been seen as responsible for the home, for feeding their families, for childcare. That has changed somewhat in the past decade, you know, since second wave feminism of the 60s and 70s. But it's changed really slowly. And so when we have, you know, a culture that starts to really embrace domestic life, certainly the pressure is still put more heavily on women. And when we, you know, are raising the bar on things like cooking, for example, you know, 50 years ago, you know, you had meat and two veg and it could come out of a can and that was a good dinner. Now, you know, at least if you're, you know, if you're educated and you're upper middle class, well, hey, you know, you need to have it be homemade. You need to have it, you know, maybe from the farmer's market. Is there BPA in that? Is there this? Is there that? And that just really raises the bar and puts a lot more pressure on people and especially on women.
And you've talked about some popular cultures, folks in the popular culture, Michael Pollan to name one, who you think have been unfair to women in some ways as part of this whole movement toward a more wholesome and local lifestyle.
Well, I think a lot of food writers, and Michael Pollan I've called out in particular, have sort of had a very historically inaccurate take on what went wrong with our food culture. And Pollan has at times in his writing, you know, said things to the effect of, well, you know, it was feminism that taught women that cooking was drudgery. And I said, you know, hey, you look back at the historical record, you look at women's, you know, diaries from the 1800s, from the 1700s, from further back, cooking was no doubt drudgery. You know, you were hauling water from wells. You were, you know, kneading bread with your hands. You were plucking chickens every morning. That was really hard work. And, you know, Betty Friedan, she didn't invent, you know, women not wanting to be the sole, you know, solely responsible for housework day in and day out. She just chronicled the problem that was already there. So I think that's unfair. There are lots of reasons why, you know, food culture has changed over the past 50 to 100 years, but feminism's not responsible for its downfall.
How would you say, do you see this trend continuing? Where do you think it's going?
I absolutely see it continuing. You know, we are only becoming more concerned and more worried about the environment, which is a big part of this. You know, people wanting to live more sustainable lifestyles, to live lower on the food chain, and that's not changing. And I also think that younger people, and this is, you know, this is measurable. There have been plenty of studies showing that, you know, people in, you know, the so-called Gen Y are much more likely than baby boomers to describe themselves as home-centric and much less likely than baby boomers to describe themselves as work-centric, which doesn't mean they're not ambitious, but I think there's a different definition of what success is, and success for them involves more work-life balance, and it involves, you know, more time spent with family, more time in the home, because I think they've seen that, you know, throwing yourself into your job completely to the absence of other activities is not necessarily a path to happiness. And, you know, and it's not a path to stability necessarily. You know, people have been laid off so much, you know, in their 50s and 60s with the recession that I think, you know, young people have a real healthy skepticism of that.
Does the new domesticity look different as you travel around the country? Is it different from place to place?
You know, it is in some, you know, sort of more surface ways. I interviewed people here, you know, in the Triangle, in North Carolina. I interviewed people, you know, in New York, in Brooklyn, in Chicago, in California, in Canada. And I think, you know, the main difference is probably kind of how much you can do in the space that you have. You know, here in North Carolina, you have people who, you know, are trying to, you know, maybe go off grid entirely, who say, you know, I want to live sustainably. I want to, you know, make my own power. In Brooklyn, that's not happening. But I did meet people who were, you know, raising rabbits in their backyard in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and, you know, backyards the size of postage stamps. So it was really fascinating to see how much people were, you know, willing to bend their lives around their commitment to this new domesticity.
And you mentioned this earlier, but I want to focus on it a little bit. This really is a kind of class distinction as well, or a class function. This has to do with generally upper middle class, well-educated people involved in this, or does it span other classes and races as well?
Well, you know, when I started researching my book, I really thought that this was going to be a very sort of elite phenomenon, you know, upper middle class, you know, upper class people who had all sorts of resources. What I actually found is that this is really a broadly middle class phenomenon. So obviously it's people that have some resources to be doing this stuff. And it's definitely people who have education, you know, who, you know, have the education to know and be concerned with, you know, with the environment and with food and all sorts of things. But most of these people were not super privileged. You know, if they were really privileged, if they were part of the elite, you know, they could just hire babysitters, you know, or great nannies to deal with their child care, and they could buy all their food from Whole Food and not need to worry, you know, where it comes from. But middle class people, you know, they really have more incentive to do it themselves because they can't just afford to throw money at all their problems. And so I really see this as a broadly middle class phenomenon.
Interesting. So people are coming at it from different points of view and for different reasons, but it's building as this trend. So is any of it connecting in a way that creates businesses and business models more than just supplying for my own home and hearth? I can actually create a business if I connect with people around the country.
Well, you know, as I'm sure most listeners have seen, there's been such a big growth in, you know, small, you know, at-home businesses, in Etsy, which is, you know, the website where you can sell your crafts online directly to consumers, in farmers markets and craft fairs, and, you know, women or men who are, you know, making cupcakes or pies from their home to sell. So this sort of, you know, artisan economy has really become a big thing in the past few years. Unfortunately, it's not necessarily an easy way to make money, and it's not necessarily going to pay the major bills. But we do see, you know, this becoming, you know, a way for people to make money on the side doing what they already love doing. And I think a lot of people hope that this artisan economy will become a bigger thing and we can return to a more sort of local, smaller economy, you know.
And it certainly can. I mean, you eliminate a lot of supervisory costs and shareholders, for one. They are a huge drain on your operating day-to-day because you got to keep paying them, and they're just sitting there waiting for their quarterly statement. It has potential. I know you focused on women, but are men playing – how big a part do men play in this new phenomenon?
Oh, you know, absolutely. I mean, I focused on women in this book because I was looking at this as part of, you know, women's history, sort of through the lens of women's history. But I definitely interviewed many men, talked to many men, and men are a huge part of this. You know, men, especially younger men, they you know, they want to have balance in their lives and they want to participate equally in both the domestic and the work realm. It hasn't happened yet, but it is happening maybe quite slowly. You know, young men are much more interested in cooking. They're much more interested in spending time with their children. They will say that they want to have, you know, equal partnerships when it comes to child rearing. And a lot of men are very involved in DIY. You do see some gendered breakdowns. You know, men may be more into, you know, pickling and women are into jam canning. And, you know, there aren't a lot of men knitting. There are some. I've met some. But, you know, you see certain historical gender divides. But certainly men are a big part of this, and men's changing changing relationship to domesticity is such a huge part of this.
Fascinating stuff, Emily. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thanks. It was a pleasure.
Emily Matcher's book is called Homeward Bound, Why Women Are Embracing the New Domesticity. She's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight at 7, tomorrow at 7 at The Regulator, and then May 30th, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. Coming up next, we'll listen to the Jewish cantata. Stay tuned.